Okay, so here we are, week two, social theory of law. What I want to talk about today is natural law theory. But before we get to that, I just want to make a couple of observations about the module materials that I've put up on my website. I hope you've all received an email about where it is and so forth. The first thing I want to say is with regard to the essay question that I've assigned, if you have had a look at it yet, the thing that you will notice, it may seem to you a little peculiar, because what I'm asking you to do in the essay question is to select one of four theorists and to discuss the extent to which their views are either irrelevant or an error with regard to our contemporary understanding of the law. And so the four figures are, I believe, Max Weber, Roberto Unger, who is the founder of Critical Legal Studies, who will be discussing this term. Max Weber's views will come up periodically over the course of the term, and I believe you probably were told something about him last term. Is that correct, Max Weber? He came up last term too? Okay. Another person who you could be writing about is Peter Singer of the Animal Rights Movement, whose work will become more relevant in the last two or three weeks of this module. And then Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is one of the founders of the legal realism movement in the United States and whose work we'll be looking at directly in the middle of this term. So the idea here is you pick one of these figures and you discuss the extent to which their views are either irrelevant or an error. That is what the essay is about. Okay, and you've got four people you could be picking from. On week seven, you are to turn in a kind of draft of less than 1,000 words, so it doesn't have to be a full paper by any means, but some sense of what the kind of argument you're going to be running with on this topic, and you send it to your seminar leader. Send it in the beginning. Well, it doesn't have to be the beginning of week seven. It could be any time in week seven. And then you can be sure to get some kind of response by the end of this term, so you'll have something to take away when you're working on it over the holidays. Okay? So I just want to alert you to that. That's one thing that may surprise you if you don't notice it right away. And what that means, in effect, is that, you know, you should start thinking right now, because some of these people who I've mentioned aren't really going to be discussed very fully until the second half of this module. Okay? So you need to kind of begin to think about this now, even before these people are formally discussed. Okay, so I've just put that there for you to look at. The other thing I want to say is, in terms of the logic of how we're proceeding here, if you have to sort of figure out what is a kind of thread that's going to be running through the different lectures I'll be giving, I think, you know, if you recall last week's lecture, a very important issue, I think, is the source of the law's normativity, okay? As I was mentioning last week, right, there are these two senses of normativity. One is, as it were, a factual sense, right? What are the norms governing the society, right? What does it mean to obey the laws in society, right? And this is, you might say, a factual matter. Different societies have different laws and different norms, and they provide a kind of foundation at a factual level, you might say, for all the other legislation that is done. And, you know, when we talk about the norm as a fact in that sense, right, you may recall, I think you may have already covered some Hans Kelsen last term, right? Hans Kelsen talks about the Grundnorm, right, which is this kind of the foundation of any kind of legal system, right? Ultimate fact about the legal system, or ultimate principle. It's like a constitutional notion, okay? And that is very much kind of one way of thinking about the normativity of the law. Namely, it is what the law says, right? The law's laid down, and that is the law. And that is what you ought to do, because that's what the law is. What the law is what you ought to do. Simple as that. What the law is what you ought to do. And that's a kind of first-order, ground-level notion of normativity, right? But there is this other kind of normativity, this kind of second-order notion of normativity, which is what natural law relates to, okay? So it gives you a sense of where we're starting from. And that's this idea of there being a higher law, right? In other words, there's not just the law that's on the books, right, that happens to be the facts about how the way the society runs. There's not just that. There is some other kind of normativity, namely, how should the laws themselves be? What are the laws for? Right, so when we talk about the idea of an unjust law, right, an unjust law may, as a matter of fact, be a law. Right, so at the first order level, it is a law. It is a law on the books. But somehow people are saying it's unjust. And how do you say unjust in this context? You're appealing to a higher sense of law. Right? You get the idea. This is very much, I mean, the notion of justice is very much tied up with the idea of higher law. Right? And when we talk about justice, you know, again, if you've done some jurisprudence, you always know, that, you know, when we talk about justice, notions of fairness are never too far away. Right? And justice has something to do with whether the laws are being applied properly, are being applied in the right spirit. Right? When we start talking about all those kinds of notions, we're making an implicit appeal to a higher law. A law by which the laws themselves are judged. Okay? And natural law belongs to that tradition of a second-order notion of normativity, right? The idea of the laws as they ought to be. Okay. So, and what we're going to do, basically, over the course of this term, you might say, is to think about what happens as this notion, this higher law notion, gets secularized. Because one of the things that we will learn very quickly is that there's a very strong theological dimension to the idea of higher law. That the higher law originally is God's law, basically. Right? That God, as it were, has ultimate say over the validity of human law. That's kind of the original intuition. But what if you live in societies that are not underwritten by any kind of divine authority? Then, what do you do with this notion of higher law? Okay? And we saw last week, as I said in the lecture, that, you know, we have these people, contemporary legal theorists like Ronald Dworkin, for example, who talks about issues like the spirit of the law, right? The law serving the public good, right? And these kind of take the position of the higher law. So you could talk about certain kinds of laws as being unjust, even though they're in the books, because they do not serve the purposes for which our society stands. Right? And I think always, you know, when you look at somebody like Dworkin, who's familiar with the American context, and I think it's always a good way to look at this, civil rights legislation is, I think, a really good way of zooming in on the problem. Because after the freedom, after the emancipation of the slaves in the United States in 1862, it actually took 100 years before civil rights legislation got put in place that actually was in the spirit of the equality that was actually guaranteed in the 1860s by the U.S. Constitution. Okay? So you had a formal recognition that blacks could not be slaves, that blacks and whites were equal as citizens of the United States. That was already there with the freeing of the slaves, but that did nothing to, in fact, to affect the way in which civil rights legislation was enforced for another 100 years. And so, you know, what was going on in that period? Well, I think, you know, if you're someone like Dworkin, you're familiar with this history, what you say is that in some sense, the spirit of making blacks equal to whites was not really being respected, despite what the law on the books said. Okay? So this idea of a higher law, spirit of the law, right? Justice under the law. All these ideas is part of the second order notion of normativity. And as I say, this comes originally from natural law. So we start with natural law. Now, natural law is a very distinctive notion. And I think one way, we take it for granted now. One of the things that I said last week about it, which is that it's we often start doing the history of legal theory with natural law, because it is really the first kind of law that aspires to be the law is the law, the way the law is today. Namely, it's systematic, it covers all of society, right? It regulates the entire society, so there's a law about everything that is allowed in the society. It talks about what's permitted, what's forbidden, what's obliged. Those kinds of, you know, articulated ideas of what we expect of any kind of legal system, natural law is really the first version of that. Okay? And this comes from a period, of course, when societies, when they were talking about, you know, Roman Empire or any of the nation states that get carved out of it, right, are all living under some kind of religious authority, where there's a religious underwriting, especially Christian religious underwriting, of the political system. Okay? Now, this notion of natural law, I should point out, you know, so when we talk about the origin of it, I think it's appropriate to talk about it as something that begins in the Middle Ages, okay? So, you know, maybe 1,000 years ago, but not back to the Greeks, okay? And I want to draw a distinction, okay, between how the Greeks thought about these things and how the Christian tradition and the secularized versions of it under which we live think about it. There's a difference. In Greek legal system, and by the way, Hans Kelsen has a really nice book, if you're ever interested in... He wrote a lot of books, as you may know. And one of the books that he wrote when he was... You know, he moved to the United States from Vienna in the 1930s and settled at the University of California, Los Angeles. And one of the books he wrote was about the history of the concept of causation in the law called Society and Nature. And it's basically a meditation on the Greek origins of the law. And what he talks about in there, which is interesting from our standpoint, is the distinction between phusis, which is the Greek word for nature, you might say, versus nomos, okay? And nomos is the Greek word for law, but law understood as conventional law, like positive law, civil law, that kind of law, okay? So the point that, if you look at Plato's dialogues and you look at Aristotle and you look at all these Greek thinkers who are talking about how the world is run, okay, there is very much a preoccupation among all of these people about the relationship between the way nature works, the natural order, that's phusis. Phusis is the natural order, as it were, and the kinds of laws that human beings enact. And if you look at, you know, I don't know how many of you read Greek plays, you know, the ancient Greek dramas, the tragedies, the comedies, all these things. If you ever read that stuff, the plots of these things are very much about, in some sense, people making laws that go against nature or doing things that go against nature, right? You get these arrogant kings, right, who decide to, you know, set up rules that go against the natural order, and then revenge is wreaked upon them by nature. Okay, it's very Greek, and not only Greek, one of the things that Kelsen shows is this is very characteristic of a lot of ancient thinking, you know, in lots of different cultures. Right, so there's a natural order, and that natural order is kind of an independent order. In other words, it's not an order that necessarily can be understood in purely rational terms. So it's not like the laws of nature as in Newton. Right? Because when we think about natural law, sometimes what we think about, in the physics context especially, are the laws of nature, right? Newton has these three laws, principle of gravitation, you've heard of these things, right? And physics is a science that is very much about discovering laws. And what are these laws that physics discovers? Well, they're rational mathematical principles that enable us to predict everything that's happening in nature, right? This is kind of what physics is about. But this is not what the Greeks meant by phusis. This is not what the Greeks meant by phusis. For the Greeks, phusis is a natural order that is nature's own. It is not rationalizable. It's just there. Okay? To give you a sense of this, you know, sometimes we talk about things being, you know, that sometimes the way we act, it's just human nature. Human nature. Human nature is just there. There's only so much you can do with it. It provides some kind of you might say, ultimate point that you cannot go beyond. You can't go against human nature. You hear a lot of people talk this way, right? And that there's only certain kinds of laws that you can make to change people because ultimately you run up against human nature. Now, what is that about? Well, that is pretty close to the Phusis idea. That's close to the Greek idea, right? That there is a kind of order unto nature that cannot be rationalized. It's just there. And if you try to go against it through your conventional laws, you're going to run into trouble. Right? That's nomos. So the Greeks had this kind of view that if you're a lawmaker, the kinds of laws you ought to make ought to be ones that go with the flow of nature. Right? You cannot enforce laws that go against nature. Now, this kind of thinking, by the way, has been revived in recent years through the environmental movement, I might add. Right? That the environmental movement, in a way, wants to make an argument sometimes, saying that a lot of the pushback that nature is giving to our actions as human beings, let's say through global warming and stuff like that, is because we have had a kind of view about nature under our conventional law that is just too liberal, right? In other words, if you look at the way nature is positioned inside law, conventional law, nature's just stuff. It's things to own. It's stuff to work with. Right? Nature is understood primarily with regard to its relationship to human beings. It is rarely regarded as something that has rights in its own sense. Okay? And so the environmental movement, in a way, when it says that nature ought to have rights, or that animals ought to have rights, you know, that kind of thing, that move is, in a way, going back to this Greek sensibility about Phusis. All right? Now, as I said, this is the ancient view. But it isn't the view that actually gets us to natural law as we normally think about it. Or at least as was thought about in the Middle Ages. Okay, to do that you need a different kind of notion. And this is where the issue of God comes in. Okay, and in particular, monotheistic God, the God of Abraham, the God of the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. They're all of these, this God, whether you think about them as three different or all the same with three different names, right? This is the God we're talking about here, okay? Because this God is a lawgiver, kind of like a big person, right? If you think about Moses, the Ten Commandments, right? I mean, God, the way God does his law business, right, is very much like what a human being does, lays down the law. Right? And humans, as it were, are authorized to lay down the law because they are creatures created in the image and likeness of God. That is why humans can make laws at all, is because they're godlike. Okay? So natural law, starting with the medieval tradition, involves an understanding of nature whereby God basically tells it like it is, tells nature what it is, what it can do. God makes nature what it is. This is when we talk about the creative deity, right? This is what we're talking about. This is a different conception from what the Greeks were on about. Now, this is a really important point, okay? Because what it then enables you to imagine, right, is that somehow there is an enormous continuity between the way in which nature is governed and the way in which society is governed, right? They're kind of the same thing in the natural law theory, right? Nature isn't foreign or alien to the human. Rather, nature is just as much governed by God as the humans are, and it's the same kinds of laws that are applying. It's one system of law. Okay? But this, of course, raises some interesting questions about what is going on here. Because you can look at the situation two ways, right? Okay, let's say God is a big lawgiver, which is kind of what these people in the Middle Ages believe and what natural law theorists believe. And God, being a big lawgiver, right, is the most rational lawgiver and is putting out the best laws possible, right? Because, you know, just like the supreme human lawgiver would, right? Same kind of idea. Okay, fine. The question is, then, is God bound by the laws he creates? This is like one of the big philosophical problems of natural law theory. Right? If you have a theological position on this, if you believe in God, and God is ultimately the source of natural law, is God bound by the natural law he creates? Right? It's a kind of funny question, because we think of God as the, you know, omnipotent, all-powerful being who can do whatever the hell he wants, okay? However, once God figures out a set of laws to govern everything, is he stuck with them? After all, wouldn't he just have come up with the best ones? So if he's come up with the best ones, he doesn't need to change anymore. In fact, he shouldn't change if they're really the best ones. God should stay in place. Okay? This is a serious issue if you believe in God, because in a sense, right, God is supposed to be this all-powerful being. But it looks like God's just tied his hands. Okay? Now, this was a problem that was put forward in the 12th century by a great Muslim scholar, Averroes. I don't know if you, those of you who study Islamic stuff may know about this guy. He was the man who was a great commentator on Aristotle, and he basically developed a lot of our conceptions of natural law, which were then translated into Latin and became the basis of the Christian natural law theory that, you know, if you know about natural law theory, you know, as associated with, let's say, Thomas Aquinas. Are you familiar with Thomas Aquinas? Okay, so Thomas Aquinas is basically doing a kind of Latin Christian translation of what Averroes put on the table. Okay? Now, the thing about Averroes is very interesting, and it's one of the reasons why within Islam, he's regarded as a heretic. So there's a society that exists today among Muslims called the Averroists, and they're liberals. Okay? It's because Averroes drew the following conclusion. He said, well, you know, yes, God is all-powerful, creates the best possible world, which means the best possible laws, which means that God's bound by them. Once God's created those laws, he can't change them. We can't change them, and he can't change them. They're bound on both sides. Okay? Now, this idea turned out to be very profound for the history of not only the law, but of science. Because if you hold that view, then you don't really need to talk much about God anymore. Because you've got the laws, and the laws are the best possible laws, and they govern everything, and not even God can change them, so we don't have to worry about what God thinks. The laws are the things that govern us. And so the modern notion of law that we get, let's say the physical laws of Newton, where Newton talks about God as a lawgiver and all this kind of stuff, just like the natural law people do, he doesn't have to say much about God beyond that, because God's bound by those laws. So if you know what the laws of nature are, you know how God's mind works. There's nothing more to God, because God's stuck with those laws just as much as you are. You see what I'm doing? You see what's going on here? God no longer needs to have a separate existence from the laws if God's bound by the laws he creates, because they're the best possible laws. There's no longer a mystery of God to figure out. The answer's there. It's in the law. And so when you hear physicists like Stephen Hawking and other people talking about, when we study the laws of physics, we're getting into the mind of God, that's what they mean. There's nothing else but the mind of God are the laws of physics. Okay? Now, this got Averroes into an enormous amount of trouble because there was no separate existence between God and the laws. So already a kind of secularization was taking place. But this was not the view that dominated in the Christian world. In the Christian world, and this is where Thomas Aquinas becomes very important, that Aquinas was very much concerned that the laws are not so deterministic, that God could change his mind if he wants to, and that therefore God has an independent existence worth thinking about. And that keeps everybody on side with regard to the faith. And that's Thomas. So for Thomas Aquinas, there's natural law, but there are also these higher other laws that we don't necessarily know what they are. Okay? Now that's an issue about, you know, what, how natural law theory how does natural law theory establish its normativity, right? It's the best possible law. Why? Because God did it. But if God did it, do we need God anymore? Right? That's kind of how the logic works on this. The other point that's worth stressing, and I mentioned this earlier, is the fact that the kind of laws that we enact as human beings are just like the laws that God enact in the sense that they bring things into being. Right? When God, you know, God creates through the Word, right? We create through the Word too, through the laws that we enact. So we are the ones who determine through our laws what is legitimate, what is illegitimate, what is just, what is not just. And the issue then becomes whether you can derive those judgments from the higher natural law. So there has to, again, be this consistency across different levels of the law. Very much part of the natural law principle. Now, in practice, the way the Catholic Church interpreted this, which was quite interesting, was that Christianity is a kind of a funny religion with regard to ordinary convention. Okay, so if you look at, you know, as you know, Christianity is a the same thing applies to Islam, a proselytizing religion. That is to say, it's in the business of converting people. Right? They convert people. And why do you need to convert people? Well, because people don't already start out believing this thing necessarily. And so one of the great issues that arises in the history of Christianity as it's spreading across Europe is, given its kind of sensibility with regard to how the law is grounded in a certain kind of conception of God and all the rest of it, what do you then do with the kinds of customs and laws that are already in place? Right? So if you've got, you know, you imagine Christianity becomes the official religion of Rome in the 4th century, and then it starts spreading outward everywhere. But, you know, as it moves across the Alps into Germany, into France, into England, right? As it moves into all these places, it has to confront local customs, local ways of being, and the question is going to be, what is the relationship between this kind of higher law that Christianity is promoting and the actual conventions and customs of people on the ground? Do they have to radically transform their lives and the way they organize themselves in order to be compatible with this law? And for the most part, the answer was no. Okay? The answer was no. And how, some of you know about European Union law, how European Union law works, okay? And you may know that there is this principle of subsidiarity, right? Where issues that issues are resolved at the lowest level possible in the legal system. So if an issue arises in Germany, it will be resolved in Germany without having to go through Brussels, unless it's contradicting some higher order principle, right? Or if some, you know, an issue happens in the UK, it gets resolved in the UK court, unless the resolution violates some higher order principle, in which case then it gets kicked up into Brussels or Strasbourg or someplace like that. This is an idea that's taken from natural law theory. Natural law worked this way. So when we had all of Christendom unified under natural law, before we had the kind of modern nation states, each of which had their own civil law traditions, before we got that in the, well, let's say the 15th century, this was the way in which law was organized in medieval Europe, very much like what European Union law is trying to do, where in fact disputes would be resolved at the local level and would only be kicked upstairs if there was some conflict with a higher order principle. Okay? And what this then did was it allowed considerable amount of difference and liberality and all the rest of it. And in fact, it also provided a kind of opportunity for heretics and other people to flourish in a way, because in a sense it was a very loosely regulated system. Natural law regimes were very loosely regulated typically. Okay. Now, one of the things that's quite interesting about natural law theory is it also had this kind of dual issue going on with regard to the relationship between the ruler and the ruled. Because on the one hand, natural law theory definitely had a sense of an idea of there being a hierarchy, right? And natural law theory was responsible to a large extent for naturalizing legal relations. In other words, it was through natural law theory that you got this idea that your default identity should be transmitted to you by your parents, right? I mean, it's an interesting point, right, about the way we live in the world, that, you know, how do you figure out, how do we know who you are in the first instance? Well, we know your name, and your name refers to your family, usually, and we can trace where you came from that way. We can also, of course, trace you through other means, but in terms of what the default identity marker is, even today, it's through family lines. Okay? That's a natural law idea. That is a, you know, and so the idea being that the family lineage, the kinship ties, provides a kind of de facto social structure which the law codifies. And the law codifies this through things like figuring out who's going to get the inheritance once the grandma dies or the grandpa. Who gets the stuff? How do you keep wealth flowing in the society generation after generation? How does property flow, right? All of those kinds of natural law underwrote all that stuff as natural. Basically, that the natural order is expressed that way, that there's a kind of biological character to the natural order, which is something that the law validates. And indeed, this is one of the reasons why the question of legitimacy of birth is such a big deal in this tradition. And of course, you know, the idea of, so the illegitimate children is a real problem at a conceptual level for this position. Because this position, at the end of the day, wants to establish default identity in terms of family. Because that is the way the natural order is normally transmitted. And this is why there's, in natural law tradition, there is an enormous stress placed on the family as the place where you get the normative sensibility that then enables you to obey the law with enthusiasm. Okay? And you could think about the Catholic moral sensibility here. It's very much part of that. Okay? So there's that side of the natural law tradition which basically naturalizes human relations, keeps everybody in place, you might say, right? And so when we get to the Industrial Revolution and we get to the sort of the rise of liberalism in the late 18th, early 19th century, it is a direct frontal attack on this idea. A direct frontal attack on the idea that your identity is primarily established through your birth. And that's where modern law comes in and positive law comes in with full force. Right, the ability to have contracts, to renegotiate your identity through job, through whatever, through moving house, all of that that's the kind of frontal assault on natural law theory with regard to how you establish identity. So that's one part of natural law. That's the part of natural law that's actually very conservative, you might say, and anti-modern even. But there's the other side of natural law theory. And this is the one that actually carries through into the modern period. And this is very much the captured in a very natural law idea, and that is the right to revolution. Now, it is through natural law theory that you get the first statement of the idea that when you're treated unjustly in a systematic manner, then the legal ties that you have to the person causing this problem are severed. Right? You can have recourse to violence. But notice one thing, just before we get too excited about this idea. The term revolution in Latin, in the original way it was presented in natural law theory, revolution means a turning around. Right? Earth goes around the sun. That's a revolution. That's what it literally is, a revolution going around. Okay? So the right to revolution, originally, in the natural law tradition, was a matter of restoring the natural order. In other words, let us say the master of a manor is abusing the serf, not giving the serf enough of a cut from the crops to be able to live properly, right? All kinds of horrible things may be happening on the farm, right? The master's abusing his power and his privilege to the serf. And the serf revolts, okay? The serf is revolting for the purpose of restoring the natural order, which is for the Lord to treat the serf with respect, but does not change the relation of domination, right? Because if you're a lord, you do not have absolute control over the life of the serf. You have legally prescribed rights and duties to the serf. Right? So just as you can demand from the serf to produce a certain amount of crop, you are also then obliged to provide for the home and the security for the serf living on your land. Those are reciprocal rights and obligations. That is a natural law. And if the Lord violates this, because he doesn't see anyone watching or whatever, right? He has a big manor, he can do whatever the hell he wants, who's going to find out? Right? That opens up the right to revolt on the part of the serf. But to restore the natural order. Not for the serf to redistribute the land, not for the serf to become an equal to the master or anything of that sort. No, 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 that's not on the cards. What's on the cards is to restore the natural order, which is an order of domination still, but one where the rights and the duties are mutually recognized and respected. Okay? Hegel's all over this. If you ever read Hegel's Master-Serf Dialectic, this is what he's talking about. He's talking about this. Hegel, right? You've heard about the master-servant dialectic. It's one of the bases on which Marx launches his ideas about revolution. Well, it comes from this. It comes from a reflection on this. Now, this is a very interesting idea, this sense of the right to revolution, because one of the things that natural law theory is recognizing in the process is the fact that all human beings are equally covered under the law. The law is not merely an instrument for the powerful to get whatever they want. The law is a vehicle for everyone to do what they're supposed to do. Okay, so we're talking of, this is a very, you know, to modern ears this may sound a little strange, but the idea here is to say there's a natural hierarchy, but everyone is equally protected in that hierarchy, in the roles that they're assigned to. Okay? So when you go into the 19th century and you start looking at some of the thinkers in the United States defending slavery, you know, even up to the time of the American Civil War, 1860s, right? One of the guys you run across is this man, John C. Calhoun, okay, Senator of South Carolina, who wrote a disquisition on government, a very interesting kind of document, and he was arguing that in agricultural societies, natural law had to rule, right? And that meant that there had to be a natural hierarchy among people, and that included the masters on top and the slaves on the bottom, but what mattered was whether there was mutual respect of the people occupying those positions. And that all the slave revolts that you see in the 19th century, Calhoun argued, could be explained by the mistreatment of the slaves, not any kind of call for universal human rights. Okay? And this is, natural law theory gives you that kind of angle to run on that. You can run that kind of angle with natural law theory. That everybody's got their place, and that place, however, needs to be respected as that place. Okay? So this idea, though, gets challenged very much in the modern period. And the people who are most responsible for challenging this, and so you look at Chernilo's chapter, right, and you look at these thinkers from the 17th and 18th centuries, right? These thinkers, what they have in common is they're very much influenced by the Protestant Reformation. Okay? Because what Protestantism does is it basically, you know, the way we normally think about Protestantism is, you know, it's a sort of anti-Catholic Christian movement, and it's against the authority of the Pope. And I think the way to understand it in contemporary terms is, you know, Protestantism
is the movement within Christianity where the Christians took back their religion. Right? So in other words, the religion was no longer in the hands of the priests. It was no longer in the hands of the theologians. It was no longer in the hands of the guys in Rome. Right? But it was democratized. You know, and it kind of took very literally, and you know, when we talk about biblical literalism, that is a Protestant thing, it took very literally the idea that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God, and that we are all potential lawmakers. So it flattened the hierarchies. That natural law theory continued. Okay? And so you can already see, when you see that Protestant move take place of getting rid of the hierarchies of the church as a basis for legitimating the law, you can see we're moving, going to be moving pretty quickly in the direction of liberalism. Because basically we're going to talk about every individual as potentially a law unto themselves. Okay? And so it's at that point then that the whole model for the legal system starts to change, right? So that in natural law theory, as I was saying, the law is based largely on family kinship ties, default identities that you're born into, right? That's how natural law theory normally thinks about things. That's the default position. Things like contracts do happen, but they're on the margins. For the most part, what you can do in the society is determined by your birth. That's natural law theory. However, when you get to this new wave, this kind of secularized version of natural law theory that comes with Protestantism, the contract becomes the signature legal relation. So we talk about social contract theory, right? Social contract theory. That is a radical idea that you start to get in the 16th and 17th century, because it is thinking about building up the entire legal system through contracts. And what do contracts involve? They involve individuals as equals agreeing to certain things under certain circumstances. It is the self-creation of the law. You and I agree to something that mutually binds us. We create a little legal system between us. And we have ways of enforcing it. And if both sides of this relationship don't work, we have other ways of enforcing it. And so the point about social contract theory, whether we're talking about Hobbes or Rousseau or Locke, you know, all of whom have different views on this matter because they have different assumptions about the way human beings are, right? Nevertheless, what is common to them all is this idea that human beings are individual, self-governing, self-legislating agents. People can decide for themselves. Again, that was a radical idea. That's getting us into a very modern mindset. That is not the mindset that says, okay, I was born a slave, therefore I will be a slave and you will treat me like a slave and everything will be fine. That's not the world we're talking about anymore. We're talking about a world where you're taking very literally the idea that everyone's creating the image and likeness of God, and so everybody's got the right to engage in free contractual relations with other people. And that is how you build up society. Okay? You think about all the things that are made possible this way. Well, you could start talking about things like capitalism, for example, right? Even democracy becomes a much more of a reasonable proposition under these circumstances, because you're basically organizing the law around individuals interacting with each other, and so the more individuals who are willing to organize together, right, the more of a legal standing you've got. Okay, that's a very important point. Because you think about it, throughout most of history, most of humanity has been poor and voiceless because of the hierarchical nature of something like natural law theory. But when you get to the modern era and you start to come up with this very secular view of natural law theory, which says that we are all kind of gods who can legislate amongst ourselves and create our own societies and our own worlds, then you open yourself up to radical democratic possibilities. Okay? I cannot emphasize too much how the theological dimension of this remained even in the modern era. So that if you, you know, again, you know, if you're from the United States, as I am, we are all, you know, you read the founding fathers of the United States, these guys like Jefferson and Franklin, all these major figures who were very much influenced by social contract theory, and who, when they were writing the Declaration of Independence, right, and then they wrote the Constitution, these people were very much, their conception of human beings were as God-created, self-legislating beings who are going to come up with a rational society that is rational like the world God has put us in. So these are guys who believed in the Enlightenment, they believed in Newton, they believed the rational world order that they could see through laws of physics was something that God put there, and that they had those powers too in themselves. It was the same, they believed this, so they like to talk, so you start to get a lot of discussion in this period about government as machinery. Mechanism. Just like the world order is a mechanism and a machine that God created, our government is a mechanism that's created that way. Okay? Now see, I emphasize all this because one of the things that becomes very interesting when you start to make this shift from natural law theory to this more secular version of it that you start to get with social contract theory is that you get people suddenly having tremendous faith in what the law can create. In other words, the law is no longer just something that maintains the social order, which is what natural law theory essentially did, right? The natural law theory basically maintained the status quo. That was its point, right? But with the modern era, with social contract theory, you actually get an idea that the law can create things. Just like God can create with the word, the law can create. Through contracts, we can create corporations. Right? We can create all kinds of arrangements. And these arrangements may acquire lives of their own. You think about a corporation, for example. Or you think about something like a city. We talk about cities being incorporated, right? Right? Universities. All of these large-scale entities which have a protected legal status above and beyond the individuals who compose them at any given time. These are creations of the law. Sometimes in the law, one refers to them as legal fictions. But I think this does them down. These are real entities that the law creates and allows. They have an enormous amount of power in the world. Ask any multinational corporation. It's the law that keeps those things going. Okay? And so this idea of the law having enormous creative power through kind of mutual, you know, mutually beneficial associations between people. This is a secularization of natural law. In what sense is it related to natural law? Because it retains the theological core about human beings being created in the image and likeness of God, and just as God is the lawgiver, the human is the lawgiver. In natural law theory, the only humans who could really give law in this sense were kings and monarchs in the so-called divine right of kings. You've heard about this, that there is some connection between God and the ruler of your country, which the church basically sanctifies. That was very common in natural law theory. The Holy Roman Empire, all this kind of stuff. Okay? So in natural law theory, only the king who had the direct line to God was the really free person. But what you get with the secularized version, starting with the social contract, is a democratized version of that, where everybody has the right to create through the law, and that's why contracts become the foundational legal concept for the modern law. Okay, before we go, I want to just mention a book. If you're interested in this idea of the relationship between law and the construction and the revolutions that break up societies in the modern era and how we move from the natural law to the modern law tradition that way, I want to recommend the works of Harold Berman, Law and Revolution, who actually gives you the whole panoramic sweep from the Middle Ages to the modern era in quite a lot of detail. He wrote some enormous books on this topic. I think this is a really important aspect of things. And in a way, a good reason to start this way is because it gives you a sense of what's at stake sociologically with regard to something like the law. What does the law mean? And I think, you know, in the modern era, what you get is this sort of shift in the natural law sensibility from maintaining society to empowering individuals to create and to recreate society. This is kind of the way I see it, okay? All right, I will stop here, and next week we are going to continue discussing the specifically sociological critiques of natural law. Yeah?
And not doing the content specifically, but are there any, like, module packs available, or is it just going to be lecture notes and audio?
No. If you go to the website, I actually have the readings there. The readings are there. You just have to click them.
Apart from that.
No, that'll be the required stuff. That's the required. There's a lot there, actually, in terms of number of pages. So don't think you're getting off lightly. Okay? You could click all that stuff. That's the required stuff. Okay? I will periodically mention other works in the lectures that you might want to look at. Okay? Okay, we'll see you guys next week.